Would you give us your full name, please?
Leroy Chatfield. Leroy with a capital R. C-H-A-T-F-I-E-L-D.
Okay. And your the place of your birth?
I was born in Arbuckle, California, in August 21st, 1934.
Okay. And your mother and your father's names?
My mother's name was Lucille Elizabeth LeGrand, L-A, capital G-R-A-N-D-E. And my father's name was Raymond Leroy Sterling Chatfield.
Mm-hmm. What were their occupations?
My father had various occupations, so you'd have to be more specific.
What did they do to earn a living? I mean, what were some of the things he did that he had various? Just to get an idea of of you and where you come from.
Sure. Well, first of all, Arbuckle, California is a Northern California rural setting, very rural, very small towns. My father worked when he was first married for the Union Ice Company. He also worked in the shipyards for a while, Sausalito. He also managed a rice farm for an absentee hotel owner from San Francisco. My father was in the construction business. He pioneered, in our area at least, the building, the manufacturing of concrete blocks that were reinforced with poured concrete for house building. And he also pioneered radiant heat that was laid in pipes in the floors of houses, and cool water during the summertime and hot water during the wintertime. My father was also sold pesticides and traveled throughout to most of Mexico, selling rice dryers and other related agricultural products. My father also was a bill collector for Massey Harris Harvesters for many years, traveled all over the western United States collecting from farmers who were delinquent in their payments to Massey Harris. My father ultimately became a real estate developer here in Sacramento, California, after having relocated from Calusa, California, and made some money, made a name for himself in this arena, and died of cancer in 1970 at the age of 56.
Mm-hmm. And your mother?
My mother was the one of nine children from a very large rice-growing family in Williams, California, and Maxwell area. And she finished high school, and I think she had 1 year of what would consider sort of business college, I guess, mm-hmm. junior college type of courses, mm-hmm. I would think. In those days, they weren't junior colleges, I don't think. Mm-hmm. And then she married my father, and she worked. She had two boys, but she worked mostly as a clerk in a drugstore in Calusa for many years, and then later in a drugstore here in Sacramento for many years. She was always a working wife, if you will, and kept books for different businesses that my father developed, and kept books for different parishes, Catholic parishes around Sacramento area. because she was very very religious and very active.
Very active in the parish life.
In parish life, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And where did you grow up then? You were born in Arbuckle and then...
I was born in Arbuckle and I was raised in Calusa. Mm-hmm. I left home at the age of 14 to attend boarding school at Christian Brothers High School in Sacramento. And that was in 1948. And then after freshman year of high school as a boarder, then I entered the Order of the Christian Brothers in Mont La Salle, which is in the mountains out of Napa, California. And I have never gone back home since that age.
What do you see as the influences that led you on the path you just described about, you know, starting out coming into the boarding school with the Christian Brothers and a year later going into the order or, you know?
Well, I think there are many, certainly the religiosity of my mother. My father was not a Catholic. Mm-hmm. He later converted to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. I always attributed that to my mother's influence. Mm-hmm. But that was later in life. I left home by that time. Mm-hmm. My brother and I always attended Catholic schools. There was a Catholic elementary school in Calusa. And so we never attended public schools. And in that era, you have to appreciate the fact that Catholics and Protestants were not really supposed to be friendly. Mm-hmm. Because they were of different faiths and different mm-hmm. beliefs. And I think Catholics in that time felt a little put upon in terms of being discriminated against mm-hmm. in some subtle ways, mm-hmm. perhaps. Then I think another factor is that there was no Catholic high school, so after mm-hmm. I finished Catholic grammar school, mm-hmm. I either had to go to the public school, which my mother and father really did not want me to do. I didn't want to do it. My parents had little education. My mother did finish high school. Yeah. My father dropped out at freshman year of high school. Mm-hmm. And I think they were convinced that I should have more education than mm-hmm. they saw, I think, going away to a Sacramento boarding school as an opportunity mm-hmm. to expand my educational opportunities. And then at Christian Brothers, in the boarding school, I met teachers who I became very fond of, who were devoting their lives to teaching mm-hmm. and to looking after boys, high school kids, and in those days, I sound like an old man now, but in those days, they didn't have reform schools. And these many, and boarding schools sort of served as sort of a place for kids from broken homes, mm-hmm. from wards of the courts, yeah. and for people like myself. And so it was quite a mixture of tough kids and good kids, and not that the tough kids weren't good kids, but I mean, it was quite a...
They had different experiences.
It was a hurly-burly atmosphere, and it was all boys. And these men, these teachers, these mm-hmm. Christian brothers, had to make sure everyone towed the line, and they did. They ran a very structured, very strict... Mm-hmm. It wasn't a reform school. It wasn't overly rigid, but I mean, there were rules and regulations, and they were abided by at your own peril. Mm-hmm. And so it was good experience. Mm-hmm. I thrived under it, actually. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was maybe natural that I would want to sort of do the same kind of work that they did. I saw what they were doing, and so then I entered their religious order and then was with them until, well, let's see, I went in when I was 15 and I came out when I was 30, I guess. So it's been 15 years.
Okay, and in those 15 years you went through the
I went
training?
Through the high school, I went through the novitiate, I went through St. Mary's College, that was owned by the Christian Brothers. And
what did you study at St. Mary's?
I majored in philosophy and I minored in Greek and English. Okay. And so I became a high school teacher and was assigned, first of all, to Garces High School in Bakersfield for 1 year. That was my trial by fire in terms of beginning teaching, and then transferred to Sacred Heart High School in San Francisco for 5 years. I've been in the early, late 50s, early 60s. And then, lo and behold, I was transferred in 1962 back to Garces High School in Bakersfield, where I was named the assistant principal and dean of discipline and high school English, senior high school English teacher and college counselor and God knows whatever else needed to be done.
After spending those few years in San Francisco, how did you find things back in Bakersfield? What was life like? What was going on in Bakersfield at that time?
Oh, in Bakersfield, you know, it's no secret that Bakersfield in the 20s and 30s was the home of the Ku Klux Klan in California. And when I was there, the John Birch Society was in full operation, very active, a lot of chapters. They monitored teachers such as myself, circulated petitions against teachers, myself included.
What were you doing at the...
Oh, what was I doing? I was, what I thought I was doing was, I thought I was teaching young men. I were only permitted to teach boys in those days. The gospel values and the teachings of the church with respect to, primarily in those days, I was very much into peace. Activities and the civil rights movement in the South. I was very active. I was the founding organizer of a SNCC chapter in Bakersfield.
This is with the students at Garces?
With the students and the parents. I mean, parents are interested in that kind of thing. And others in the community at large. So there were professors from Bakersfield City College that were active in SNCC. And we raised funds and raised mostly money and supplies of different kinds and sent them to Mississippi during the civil rights movement. And we had speakers that would come to Bakersfield like Stokely Carmichael and Marshall Gans and others. I remember, I forget one of the other major civil rights leaders, a student came, but I specifically remember Stokely because he was very, a very good speaker, a very thoughtful speaker, I thought.
What about local Bakersfield concerns? Sounds like these activities at SNCC are focusing on civil rights movement as it develops in the South.
Well, there wasn't much going on in Bakersfield actually that wasn't related to the outside world. I didn't think. I mean, in those days, of course, Hispanics were called Mexicans, and so there was a Mexican community that was associated primarily, of course, with Our Lady Guadalupe Parish in the Bakersfield area. I had some students in my classes who were Mexicans. Most of my class members were sons of growers. And so, in a certain way, right in my own classroom, I had this sort of phenomenon where you have the very wealthy, if you will, the power structure, if you will, and then the underclass, if you will. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't any particular hostility between the two of them at all. It's just that the phenomenon seemed to be that each group knew their place. And that was the accepted reality. The only other thing of note in the terms of the Bakersfield area, but it applied to all of California, was the room for
fair housing.
And I became very active with Senator Walter Stern in that campaign, and he and I preached at many black churches primarily on the issue of, I didn't preach, but I mean I spoke, he spoke at the preaching time, I guess, mm-hmm. I don't know. And I remember one time debated the Bakersfield County Board of Realtors on this issue at Bakersfield College in front of a standing room audience only. It was very controversial. I absolutely must have been out of my mind. I was so young, I guess I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, in terms of putting myself in such a charged up atmosphere and in effect became a kind of lightning rod even at an early age for issues. In that case it was fair housing, mm-hmm. But which was of course related to civil rights and the rights of minorities.
As this kind of activity was going on and you're getting involved in like the Rumford campaign, you're essentially based at Garces, the high school.
Yeah.
What's happening with the parishes, with the pastors, with the church? You know, that in Bakersfield. And were individual clergymen getting involved in this too? Is it, you know, is it pretty much something that's essentially centered at the high school?
Well, I mean, if it were centered, it was at the high school. It was only centered in me.
Okay, well, that's.
I mean, there was. I mean, there. I mean.
Well, were you? That's probably even a more fundamental question. Were there others at the high school that were involved in this with you?
No.
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 No. No. No.
Pretty much on your own.
Pretty much on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there was. I know the name, of course this has been years and years and years since I even thought about this, but there was a professor of sociology, Wayne, I think his name was Wayne Belcher, at Bakersfield College. He was there for many years. And he was active, and he had a group that was active that I became part of. It was sort of an ad hoc group. I don't know, it's like, in every community, no matter how conservative it is or how right-wing it is or how whatever it is, you always find some people, mm-hmm. In this case it was a handful of people, I think, relatively handful of people, that were active in more, active in social action issues, but at great risk, really, mm-hmm. To your own career, right. And to your own, I don't want to say personal safety, but when you have organized campaigns, you know, sponsored by members of the John Birch Society, for example, trying to have you removed from your position as a teacher or mm-hmm. as a Christian brother at the age of, I don't know, how old was I? I don't know, at the age of 25 or 26 or something like that. That's pretty yeah. scary stuff.
How did your principal react in all this?
Oh, supportive. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a couple, let's see, which principal did I have? Yes, I felt that he was supportive, mm-hmm. really. When the group appealed to the bishop out of Fresno, he's the bishop of the diocese, which included Bakersfield, but he was stationed in Fresno. He did not he did not accede to their demands. Mm-hmm. This, in fact, I remember he sent me a very short but very nice letter, right, saying that, well, he didn't quite say keep on doing what you're doing, but he certainly gave me the impression, said nice things about it, you know.
Yeah.
And I had parents. I had parents that supported me. I fancied myself as a good teacher, as a challenging teacher, as a kind of leadership type of teacher. Mm-hmm. And that cuts both ways, of course. Some students really respond well to that, and take to it, and therefore their parents, you know, are somewhat enthusiastic because their son seems to be reading books and talking about things and debating and maybe arguing at home and this and that. And, you know, I mean, some parents really think that that's, you know, what education is about. Of course, it cuts the other way, too. Some parents feel that they shouldn't be reading books that deal with these kinds of issues, and that it's leading their son astray, and that it's causing friction at home because he's bringing home ideas and thoughts and debating with the family, and they're getting into arguments. And, you know, I mean, nothing new.
Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, you're going to make a shift from, you know, vice principal of Garces to being the staff of the National Farm Workers Association. Now, I know that there's a lot of layers, and, you know, I myself am an ex-seminarian. I quit in third philosophy. I was studying for Monterey Fresno, and, you know, it's not a simple, you know, one word or short answer, but more from the point of view of you, you know, stopping being Brother Gilbert and going back to be Leroy Chatfield and no longer being a vice principal, but becoming, basically switching careers, as it were.
I mean,
so could we talk a little bit about that transition?
Sure.
Where, you know, what are the steps? How do we go? We go, you know, you're involved with Rumford, with the SNCC and civil rights, and...
Well, the step is, I believe, is Boston, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. I went, 1963 in the summer, went to Boston, Massachusetts for the National Catholic Social Action Convention. And it was the first time I'd ever attended such a convention like that. And they had religious leaders and activists from all over the United States who were there. And talking about peace and civil rights and justice and da-da-da. And one of the panelists, one of the speakers, and I don't know whether it was Phil Berrigan or not, I'm not sure, but some panelists talked about Cesar Chavez and his work in Delano, California with farm workers. And I was absolutely stunned. I could not believe that I came 3,000 miles to hear about something that was supposedly happening 30 miles away from where I was, and I considered myself in the know. I mean, I was interested in things like that. And if this was happening and I didn't know about it, either I was out of it or it wasn't really happening or something. So I came back. When I came back, first thing I did was try to track down Caesar. And, of course, he did not have a telephone. And so he was not, there was no way I could telephone him. So I started calling Chavez's in the phone book in Delano and came across his brother. And so I told his brother Richard who I was, and I'd like to meet Caesar. And Richard was very guarded. I mean, I could, you know, he didn't know me. He didn't know why I wanted to. Anyway, he said he would get a message to him. And so a week went by, I don't know, maybe even longer, I can't remember, but then I got a call from Caesar. And he introduced himself, and I believe he came over to Garces High School, and we sat down and talked. Mm-hmm. I believe that's what happened. I might have gone over to Delano. Mm-hmm. I certainly did later on, but yeah. I mean, I forget which, mm-hmm. But I think he came over actually, and we just hit it off from the first mm-hmm. minutes that we met.
What was the discussion like? What did you talk about?
Oh, I was just asking him what he was doing, mm-hmm. and why he was doing it, and what was happening, and mm-hmm. and he just began to explain what. His thinking and what he wanted to do and how important it was and we just, you know, I mean, and he was interested in what he wanted to know about me and what I was doing and things I was interested in, and it was just but it just had a very simpatico type of beginning. I mean, it was just like we were sort of on the same wavelength, mm-hmm. so to speak. He was, what, I guess he was 6 years older than I at that time. And so we became fast friends, and he used to come and talk to my classes, and I would go to Delano and hang out at his mm-hmm. office and meet his family, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we talked. He was a Caesar, of course, was a great organizer, especially on a one-on-one basis. Mm-hmm. And he took time, listened, was a very thoughtful person, yeah. very wise. And so what happened was the strike broke out in September 1965. In the meantime, I had left Garces at the end of August, in July of 65. And was had enrolled at USC to study for my doctorate in social work. Mm-hmm. And so then he called me in October and asked me if I could come to Delano and work with him because he needed help. Mm-hmm. And I had organized some money and some food and stuff to bring down. And so I had kept in contact with him, of course, after the strike broke mm-hmm. out and then until he called me. So, when he called me, I mean, I basically felt I had to make a decision whether to stay as a Christian brother or to leave and to throw in with him. And
so it was as a Christian brother you're going to go to USC?
Yeah, I was a Christian brother.
You were still a...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I was living at Cathedral High School mm-hmm. right next to Dodger Stadium. And... So I told my religious superiors that I was leaving, that I had decided to leave to become an organizer for farm workers. And if you know anything about church bureaucracy and church procedure, you can appreciate that it can be a very cumbersome project for a person who is a member of a religious order and who has vows to be able to be bureaucratically released from those vows and da da da.
I was not yet ordained, clearly. I mean, third philosophy is a ways to go. However, I thought my reaction was it was a lot harder to get out of the seminary than it was to get in. The steps. You know, there were those who just disappeared, but I, you know, being a good seminarian and became a good ex-seminarian and followed it step by step. So,
yeah. I think I, maybe I'm glossing this over, but I think I had my release papers within 24 hours yeah. from the time I told them that this is what I was going to do. I think, in looking back, I think the provincial, after all, you have to remember the Christian Brothers were owners of wineries employed farm workers, and the last thing they wanted was any union activity, I think. And so I think maybe they were tickled to death. When I say they, yeah. I mean the religious provincial and others maybe were tickled to death that I was not going to be a thorn in their side. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I relocated to Delano, and the first thing was Caesar sent me off to raise funds in the Bay Area and LA area. Mm-hmm. And so I traveled constantly. Primarily from university campuses, mm-hmm. because professors were very open to this type of 60s activity, and so I became a prodigious fundraiser.
For about what length of time?
Oh, gee, it's so.
This is be late 65 then, right?
Yeah, this is late 65. I guess late 65. I got married in June of 66, and I bought a mobile home, a Fleetwood mobile home, 10 feet wide, 58 feet long, and my wife and I set up shop in Torrance, California, in a mobile home park. That was our first location after we were married. And we were fundraising in primarily the Beverly Hills and West LA area, primarily in the Jewish community, frankly, the Jewish and liberal community of Los Angeles, fundraising for the farm workers. Now, that doesn't mean that I was exclusively there. I mean, I was sometime in Delano, back and forth, you know, that kind of thing.
But Torrance is the base.
We lived in Torrance. Yeah. The base was on Olympic Boulevard.
Okay. Out of the office.
That's where the office was, yeah. On Olympic and Bundy. Mm-hmm. I think it can't be too far from where Nicole Simpson lived, I guess.
Yeah.
Sad to say. Then I produced a Joan Baez concert, I think in the fall of, maybe it was August or September of at Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. She did back-to-back benefit performances for the farm workers and raised. Oh my gosh, I'm trying to think, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, I think, which was awfully large sums in those days. And then Caesar wanted me to come back to Delano, which I did, and I became the director of the National Farm Worker Service Center, which became the charitable nonprofit parallel organization of the Farm Workers Union, which in those days was called the National Farm Workers Association.
Caesar didn't use
the word union.
Yeah.
In the early days, he told me he was afraid to use the word union because he was afraid the growers would be so, you know.
But that was organizing committee.
Yeah.
No, I think that was a little later on, actually. But anyway, I lose track of the sequence. But anyway, then we moved back, and we lived on. We put our mobile home at Arroyo Strike Camp. It was called the Arroyo Strike Camp, is what it was called, because the Filipinos, you see, they had their own organization. They were the farm youth.
Agricultural Workers
Organizing Committee. AWOC. Right. AWOC.
Yeah, and AWOC and NFWA did become UFWOC.
UFWOC, right. Yeah. That's right.
Right.
But anyway, so they had their base at Filipino Hall. And Caesar had his base at Arroyo Camp. And so we put our trailer out there and we dug our own cesspool. And that's where the first farm workers clinic was. Was out there, and that's where.
This is the service center, then, right?
No. The service center actually, the service center opened up in a house right next to, or in back of, and right next to Caesar's office, the union headquarters on Albany,
mm-hmm.
102 Albany, as mm-hmm. I recall, and. I forget what street the service center was on, but it was just that we just rented another house right next to the mm-hmm. union there, and we just converted it into a service center. I had an office there, credit union had an office, and we had an all-purpose room where we helped farm workers in whatever mm-hmm. Walk-in problems they had, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
Anything from unemployment to welfare to taxes to mm-hmm. driver's licenses to whatever it was. Yeah. Just
it was a truly multi-service center.
It was. Yeah. It was. That had been one of Caesar's dreams mm-hmm. for a long time, was to have, you know, people that were trained and who could listen and who understand what the needs were yeah. and then actually, you know, work on a one-by-one basis to actually mm-hmm. yeah. try to assist someone.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're directing the service center.
I was directing the service center.
And where and how did you get your volunteers and train them, and or were they staff people?
No, we were all... We were all volunteers. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were paid a pittance.
Well, it doesn't make much sense. It's things between staff and volunteer when the pay is $5.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's yeah, right. I mean, right. Yeah. We all thought we were volunteers. We certainly felt we were paid that way, I guess. But I mean, not that I don't mean to object to it. It was done willingly. Mm-hmm. Where did volunteers? Well, first of all, you have to realize that. The service center and the union were hand in glove. I mean, mm-hmm. they were parallel, and they were legal separations and differences. I mean, the service center, for example, oversaw the credit union and those services for farm mm-hmm. workers. And then we had a co-op gas station okay. that was part of the service center, and we oversaw that. And then the service center is the one that bought the 40 acres and built the gas station out there, and then built the clinic out there, and ultimately, you know, I mean, and so I mean, these things were done hand in glove to further to underpin, if you will, I guess, to strengthen the underpinnings of the efforts of the union. I mean, the union was getting its brains beat out. In terms of striking, in terms of boycotting, in terms of, you know, trying to fend off strike breakers and all, you know, I mean, so that was their, that was they were the guerrilla operators, if you will. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the guerrilla force, I suppose. The service center was more the human services mm-hmm. sort of approach to farm workers. Yeah. I mean, for example, the service center began, I mean, was the beginnings of the, we had the death benefit program there, and we had the beginnings of the Robert F. Kennedy Farm Workers Medical Plan, was mm-hmm. spawned out of the service center, and then the Martin Luther King Fund, that came later, you know. I mean, those were the humble beginnings, but, yeah. but so I think that's, since Caesar and I, you know, for this 10-year period, 63 to 73, were like so much in sync. I mean, we worked together on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how to,
yeah.
And I had many, many different assignments. I mean, many different.
Can we talk a little bit about something? I want to kind of run through, see sure. what you were doing that time period, and then come back and talk about some other issues that sure. kind of run through that. So,
well, you mean some of the
yeah, you said,
assignments?
Yeah, assignments. You were in charge of the service center. You,
yeah, I was in charge of the service center. Founded the co-op. Some of the then the legal department was spawned out of the service center. So that's where I met Jerry Cohen. In fact, I was the one who recruited Jerry Cohen to come to work for the union. He was a first-year attorney at just out of law school at California Rural Legal Assistance in McFarland. I'm the one that found the 40 acres. I purchased the 40 acres. When I say I mean on behalf of, you know, the union
sure.
and service center. It wasn't
yeah.
me personally, of course.
Yeah.
And developed the 40 acres. I mean, I was in charge of that. I'm the one that found La Paz up at Tehachapi. I'm the one that made the arrangements for the purchase of that and found the found the Hollywood producer to put up the money.
There's a lot of different versions. We've done about 20 interviews with people. Julio Hernandez, Bill Chandler, Irene, you know, Ramos Chandler, Dora Saludado, Antonio Saludado, Roberto Bustos. I mean, just, you know, it's a range of people that have been there.
Sure.
And we hear different versions of how La Paz came about.
Well, I have my version.
Okay, well, that's what we'd like to hear. I mean, they all sort of run together, but there's some you know, differences about. Well, let's hear your version.
My version, sure. Well, here's what happened. What I think happened.
Okay.
Caesar had talked for a long time about needing to have an international headquarters. In other words, he did not want to get tied into what would be the Delano local union, mm-hmm. because that would have its own internal politics, and also it would localize the union to much of an extent in Delano. In other words, Delano meant grapes, mm-hmm. table grapes, etc. Fine, mm-hmm. but his vision of a union and actually wanted to develop more than a union. I think, but he felt that he needed another headquarters that was not tied, would not be tied to any local. And at that headquarters, we could develop like a strike force, if you will, a boycott force, if you will, a fundraising force, if you will, and whatever we needed. I mean, we could, you know, and then strategically and tactically move about wherever we had to do, wherever we had to go. But we'd have a base that was not tied to any one sector of the union. And Caesar's favorite place in the whole world was Santa Barbara. So I looked at places in Santa Barbara that might be available. Mm-hmm. You have to remember, we didn't have any money in those days, whatever. Right. But we knew how to, raise money. I remember Caesar and I going over and looking at some places, but they were too posh. They were too, you know. I mean, they were just. I mean, they were very expensive, and they just weren't in keeping with the mm-hmm. ambiance of the farm workers' movement. And he was very sensitive about that. And I remember one time, I even found a piece of property overlooking the ocean. He loved the ocean and overlooking the ocean that was like on a hillside. And it was pretty reasonable, but no buildings. And then he had the idea, you know, maybe we could develop this into a place where farm workers and their families or ranch committees and their families could come on for vacations. And in other words, you know what I mean, they could have cabins or they could have, I mean, camping or, you know, that type of thing, you know? Well, that didn't materialize. I mean, it's not that I'm getting you off on a tangent. I'm just saying that we went through this this process, and I knew he wanted to locate, if possible, in the Santa Barbara area because he just had such feeling.
Are you working through at this time to not only a search for a location but also developing what's going to take place there? Or is that part of the discussion?
Part of the discussion is part of the dreams. Mm-hmm. So you have to remember that the way Caesar worked was, you know, things would be talked and massaged, and then they'd be dropped, and then they'd be talked and massaged again, mm-hmm. and they'd come to a new sort of level of thinking, and then other things would be added, and other things, then it would drop, and then, I mean, ultimately, you know, sort of consensus sort of built even in his own mind. I mean, after all. I mean, he didn't have a master plan. He was trying to figure out, as mm-hmm. we went along, we all were, what the hell it is we were doing, what we wanted to do, why we wanted to do it. So somehow, what came across my desk through the service center is this sanitarium that became available through Kern County. They were going to auction it off. Mm-hmm. And so I went up and took a look at it. They had a description of all the buildings and all the stuff and da-da-da. And I sort of checked it out and said to myself, you know, I mean, it's got possibilities. I mean, mountains and it's removed and da 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 da. And Caesar and I went up there, and others too, not just Caesar and I, but others went up there many times. And I think he sort of fell in love with it. And it had a lot of pluses that he was looking for, especially the fact that it had a lot of buildings. And, you know, they were, some of them were in need of repair and this and that, but there was acreage, there was buildings, there was, we could, I mean, he was a visionary. He saw that, you know, and also you have to realize, we had volunteers coming from all over the world, certainly, especially the United States and Canada, but I mean, all over the world who were, wanted to, were working on a volunteer basis with the farm workers in this movement, and housing was a problem, and feeding them was a problem, and I mean, you know, I mean, just the sheer logistics. So here would be a place, for example, where it, you know, we could accomplish some of those things. Now, so then the question is, it was going to be up for auction, and we didn't want the union or the service center to be auction, to be, you know, to be the ones, because in Kern County, it would be the death of the. We wouldn't have gotten it. That's what we felt, anyway. Mm-hmm. You have to realize that we're probably more paranoid than maybe we needed be. I don't know, but it seemed very real at the time, I'll tell you that. Mm-hmm. I found Eddie Lewis, who was a Hollywood producer, and I went to meet him. I say I found him. I mean, I forget honestly what my connection to find him was. It could be that he called and wanted to do something for the farm workers or something. You know, I forget that part of it. But I remember going to his office, and I was just blown away by his office and, I mean, all these, I don't know, period furniture and antiques. And, oh, my God, it was very, you know. And he was a very energetic, high-strung, wired-up guy and nice guy. And so he brought his wife to La Paz, and Caesar and I and others, Gilbert Flores, I think, one time was with us. Anyway, we drove it all, da-da-da. Well, so Eddie agreed to put up the money. It was 10 years, maybe, something. We would pay Mark over a period of time. Now, I forget now whether the down payment he put up, he made as a donation, and we would pay him, basically we ended up paying him, there was a mortgage, and then we would pay the money, and then he would pay the mortgage. So I have a hunch that the initial money that he put up was probably a straight donation, and then we paid off. And Frank Dennison, who was an attorney, is an attorney, and was sort of the one of the volunteer attorneys at that time, he handled all the paperwork with respect to that, to the La Paz, numbers, the purchasing of it and all that. So anyway, Lewis either went in person or he sent somebody, I forget, and they went and they bid on it, da-da-da. And then, of course, later on it came out that really it was the farm workers, and that caused quite a to-do. Yeah. Now, I don't know. That's what happened as far as I know.
Okay. Typical stories talk about a donation or it was purchased by. So it sounds like that you know, what you've just went through has kind of been meshed in some different ways where parts being left out by some people rather than, you know, this process of the producer stepping in and then, in effect, you know, facilitating the purchase of.
Well, without Eddie Lewis, we wouldn't have had the money to do it. That's pure and simple.
Well, there are stories that some famous Hollywood person bought it and gave it. You know, these are the kinds of things you hear.
No, we certainly paid a great portion of it back.
Right. Okay.
Probably, as I say, I think that initial down payment was probably a donation.
Okay. Okay. So as a staff member, then director of the service center, form co-op, legal department spin out, 40 acres purchased and developed. Now La Paz purchased and developed.
Yeah, and then Caesar would go off, you know. Now this, you know. So then we relocated to La Paz, you know, and all that. But Caesar would go off for months at a time, because of the boycott, touring the East and Canada and the Midwest, primarily the East, and fundraising and boycotting. I mean, you know, charging up troops. He'd be gone months at a time. I'm the one that ran the day-to-day operation of the union.
Okay.
Paid the bills.
Yeah.
You know, deposited the money, rent, whatever the bureaucracy of the union was, at that time. Mm-hmm. I was the one that sort of administered on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. Then when Caesar came back, he would take it back, mm-hmm. and then he would do it.
So you were the, as it were, kind of a chief administrative officer.
Yeah, I made a lot of decisions. Uh-huh. It's not like Caesar had no contact with me. We mm-hmm. we probably talked 2-3 times a day, mm-hmm. even when he was on the road.
Right.
I mean, he wanted to know everything. He was the kind of person that thrived on feedback. And the reason is, I think, is because that's how he got his best ideas, mm-hmm. was from feedback. I don't mean just from me, but from hundreds of people. And that's how he formed ideas and vision and consensus, mm-hmm. and, you know, programs. Anyway, So I made a lot of personnel decisions. The routine kind of stuff. I mean, problems of staff, problems of what was going to be done at La Paz, what was going to be fixed, all that stuff. I mean, someone did it. I mean, someone had to do it. I was the person. I mean, I don't quite know how I got there, so to speak, but I mean, I was the person. And I don't know, honestly, that anyone like that ever appointed me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like Caesar said, well, Leroy, well, and then that was it. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah. And some of the people we have interviewed have quite frankly stated that when it came to things like that, that they didn't think there was someone better than you. That you really knew how to keep things organized and working.
Well,
I mean, I'll share that with you.
Well,
you
know, I that's nice feedback. I just did it. I mean, Caesar and I were so close and so much on the same sheet of music, mm-hmm. I guess, that same page of music, that, I mean, we almost talked in shorthand, you know.
Mm-hmm. Could we talk a little bit about then, if same page of music, you're talking in shorthand, what some of the currents and thoughts that ran through that? Because, and specifically, you know, looking at things, for example, people will talk and people will write about Gandhian influences. People will write and talk about, you know, the encyclicals as an influence. Mm-hmm. You know,
and
it's a very interesting coming together. You know, I mean, earlier in the interview we talked about, you know, you mentioned the tension with Catholic and Protestant, yet here's a case where with migrant ministry you're dealing with Protestants. You come out of a very Catholic background, so can we talk about some of these things? I mean, was Gandhian philosophy really a part of the discussion, part of the debate, part of the perspective that infused what was going on, the encyclicals,
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I would say so. I think I have some comments that I could help with. Caesar was tremendously influenced by what I think was called the California Mission Band, mm-hmm. a group of priests, many of them spoke Spanish, who traveled throughout primarily the San Francisco diocese, giving retreats and workshops and stuff, and preaching social justice, and right out of the encyclicals, mm-hmm. So to speak. In other words, not preaching the encyclicals, but I mean the mm-hmm. themes, mm-hmm. and Caesar really took to that and had very high regard for these priests who did this work, and he was tremendously influenced by them. And so it affirmed and reaffirmed in his own mind the role of the church with respect to the rights of workers, mm-hmm. and the rights of Mexicans. Mexican Americans, later Chicanos. Mm-hmm. In other words, what he was doing was had a religious overtone to it, mm-hmm. and that it was worthwhile to dedicate your life to this kind of thing. Okay. It was very deep-seated belief of this type of social action and translating it into the real world and what he was doing. Now, at the same time, though, he was very open to other faiths and other philosophies, and Gandhi was certainly one. Now, when I first met Caesar, he had been in 28 elementary schools by the time he reached the 8th grade. I don't think he ever finished high school. His vocabulary was, I'd have to tell you, as an English teacher, was poor, was relatively elementary.
This is when you first met?
When I first met him.
Mm-hmm.
By 1968, after I began working with him, so the first two or three years, by the end of the third year, because of his reading, his vocabulary had developed it had quadrupled. It was tenfold. And he was a faithful reader of Gandhi. Mm-hmm. He read parts of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give you the impression, because I don't think he was a daily Bible reader, mm-hmm. in the sense that a scripture scholar or study, you know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
But he read books, especially to do with the Kennedys or, you know.
We hear references to reading labor history.
Labor, yes. About the labor leaders.
Labor leaders, okay.
Yeah, not so much, you know, the more personalized.
Okay, so he would read about Gompers rather than the FFL.
That's right.
Okay.
And he formed very strong opinions about unions and what he would not do as mm-hmm. a union leader. Yeah. In other words, the kinds of things that he would not do, mm-hmm. and that he would never settle for having a union that just was about wages and working conditions.
Okay.
That there was more to life than just that. So he was an avid reader and a disciplined reader, a faithful reader. In other words,
Did he set aside time every day to read?
Yes, he did. Yeah. Yes. And he would get up very early in the morning. He kept prodigious hours. I mean, this man lived two lifetimes in one lifetime. He was a very early riser, and he went to bed when he fell asleep. You know, which would be after midnight. I mean, he was a hard worker.
Yeah.
And so he was a very, obviously he was a very, very intelligent person. So when he was associating with people who were educated,
mm-hmm.
With attorneys, with doctors, with me, let's say, mm-hmm. a teacher, he had a very sharp ear. So he also soaked up vocabulary, soaked up ideas, he soaked up nuances of language by listening. He was a great listener. But he spoke with great authority. When he spoke with great authority. Mm-hmm. And he always had the last word. Always. There was never any question.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether the discussion went on for an hour or it went on for days or weeks, mm-hmm. and many of them did. When Caesar finally spoke, that was it. Then the discussion stopped, the debate was over, and it mm-hmm. was time to get to work, and we were all together. Probably part of the reason is we were so fucking exhausted. You just get to the point. It wasn't like that, that when the discussion started and Caesar said, this is the way it's going to be, and then we had to go through this horrible, agonizing weeks or days or whatever it was. And then at the end, Caesar said, well, I said this in the beginning and now. No.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a genuine give and take.
There was a process.
There was a process. Mm-hmm. It was a process. Mm-hmm. And Caesar loved to hear people give forth. And he listened. It doesn't mean he agreed.
Yeah.
Sometimes he would argue and get very annoyed.
He engaged in that process.
Engaged.
He was not just an observer who gave a summary.
He didn't just sit back and then put it all together. No, he was a participant. But Caesar was, I mean, I've said this a dozen times, but it's very, very true. He was just a very keen listener. Mm-hmm. And so you felt when you were talking with him that you had his undivided attention. Mm-hmm. And you did.
Yeah.
He would not be rushed. He wouldn't be distracted. He took time with people. I mean, probably too much time. I mean, you know, but that's the way mm-hmm. he was. I mean, you know, he was a terrible public speaker. Always was. I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Never felt comfortable. But with a person or a small group or whatever, mm-hmm. he could hold forth for hours. I don't mean just doing all the talking,
right.
but engaged.
Mm-hmm.
But he was always organizing you. Always, always mm-hmm. organizing you. That was his. Mm-hmm. That was his life.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the? Well, one of the elements, influences. Is the Industrial Areas Foundation because of the training with the CSO and then mm-hmm. and subsequent, you know, contacts with it.
Mm-hmm.
Does that continue to be an element? Or is it something that was in an earlier part of the process was an element?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think Saul Alinsky had much use for Caesar. Now, I didn't know Saul Alinsky, so I'm... but I don't think... I knew Caesar very well, and I don't think Caesar had much regard for Saul Alinsky either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not... I don't...
So the differences are more than just... There's references to differences on the... utility and usefulness of house meetings as an organizing tool, but so the differences go.
Oh yeah, there's nothing to do with that.
That's just superficial.
That's right. No. It's not that he didn't think that the tactics or the method or the process was excellent. He thought it probably was, especially you mentioned house meetings. But no. I think there's more to. I don't know. I don't know Saul Alinsky, so it's not fair for mm-hmm. me. And I'm not, so I'll be careful. I'll try to be careful.
Well,
but mm-hmm. I do know Caesar. Caesar mm-hmm. lived what he preached. This man lived a life of voluntary poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think you can take a look at community organizers or union leaders in this country and say that they lived a life of voluntary poverty and that they gave mm-hmm. of themselves at that level. You know, I mean, this man did not own anything. I mean, he was poorer than, you know, than a Franciscan monk. I mean, he didn't own anything, basically. And he didn't put on airs, and he didn't dress to suit the occasion. And I mean, he was just him. He was himself, and he considered himself a person of the people, and that they were suffering, and that to empower them, if you will, he had to show that he was willing to live at a level that they could see that he didn't have to live at. But he chose to live at that level. They knew that he could have had a high government appointed position in the Kennedy administration or in the Johnson administration. Yeah. I mean, he could have had, you know, they knew that. But he chose not to have those things. Now, what I think Caesar... I mean, Caesar's belief in Fred Ross Sr. as the premier organizer. I mean, there is no question in my mind the high regard that he held with Fred Ross Sr. And when and Fred Ross Sr. in the beginning days was not involved with the union. I don't know why or why not. I'm sure he had other jobs. I don't know. But there came a point when he could be involved, and Caesar wanted him involved, and Caesar paid, because I'm the one that paid, paid to have Fred Ross involved. Now, I don't mean overpaid. I just mean that Fred Ross Sr. was the exception in Caesar's mind in terms of people being paid, which he wanted to have Fred. Now, Fred didn't run the... Fred was not... He didn't organize for the whole union, but he had areas of responsibility, the DiGiorgio campaign, for example. Now, Caesar approved of Fred's methods in the sense of his charts and his detail and his daily meetings, twice a day, morning and evening, and house meetings and the discipline that he expected of the organizers that were assigned to him, and we had dozens of volunteers, you know. Now, so that I can attest to, and that he felt that Fred was effective. Fred Sr. was a very difficult person to work for, and I dare say there, while he was tremendously effective, most people, many people could not work for him because of his rigidity in terms of the way it had to be done, and you know. That works both ways. I mean, a lot is accomplished, but it's my way or no way, and that works. That works, and it doesn't work.
You can accomplish certain goals, but there may be costs.
That's right. Yeah. Always costs. Always costs. Yeah. But that wasn't Fred's problem. Fred's problem was, hey, this you want me? This is what I do. This is how I do it. Take it or leave it. No hard feelings.
Yeah.
And Caesar took it. And I mean, he wanted that and needed that for certain kinds of campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Like the Jumara was a particularly difficult one.
Yes. The one I'm thinking was DiGiorgio.
DiGiorgio?
Yeah, okay. I'm not sure the Jumara campaign was.
Because I remember, I remember Junior out there in the press and...
Well, Fred Ross Jr. was...
No, I mean Junior Jumara.
Oh, Junior Jumara. Oh, yes. But see, one of the life and death crossroads of the union was the DiGiorgio
strike.
The election. And that's what Fred Ross ran, was the election. Mm-hmm. In other words, who was going to vote? Who was going to vote for the union? Who was going to vote against the union? I mean, you know, and all of that organizing that went around that. I mean, it was a major... If the union had lost that election, it could have publicly doomed the union in the eyes of the public. Well, here's where farm workers had a chance to vote, and my God, they didn't even vote for the union, right? I mean, you know, it would have been... So...
Do you remember how the idea of getting the ALRB to allow the union to bring back workers that had worked there in the past, how that arose, and who managed that process with the board?
No, I don't know that. Specifically, I just know that in that first summer of the ALRB, that first summer of elections, there were more than 40,000 farm workers that voted in that in that series of elections. You know, many, many elections. I don't know the nuances of what you're talking about there. That's probably because the general counsel's office before the ALRB probably handled that aspect of it. In other words, who was eligible to vote, who wasn't eligible to vote, and that'd be my hunch.
Yeah.
But I don't know who, how that all came about.
Yeah. Well, after it came about, I think there was a logistic problem of getting people back. Because that whole issue of those who had worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, at that point in time, you see, I was not on the ground with respect to the Farm Workers Union or its... See, I left in 1963, August of 1973, I left the union and began over again. I started a new career, new careers. And while I didn't break, while it was a very friendly separation, and my relationship with Caesar remained very good, it could no longer be the same. Anyone who has been involved in a movement or a cause understands that your friends, the friends are the people that you're working with on a daily basis, and when they spin out of the circle, you don't say they're enemies, or you still say that's my friend, but it's not a working friend. It's not, and Caesar nor I are the kind of people that live in the past. So I saw the union then as an outsider, if you will, and completely different perspective.
At one point we were talking about finding a place, looking in Santa Barbara and then settling in La Paz. You said that Cesar had this vision, dream of developing more than a union.
Right. Oh, yes.
What was this more?
The way he explained it to himself was he wanted to have farm workers be able to participate in cooperatives, co-ops. He thought that the credit union was one of the most it was one of the most empowering things that had ever been developed for poor people. The idea that poor people could pool their money, as little as it was, create a resource and help one another and expand their opportunity and pay it back over an organized basis and da 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 da. I mean, he took great personal delight and pleasure in the idea of, and he participated in the credit union and sold it to others and farm workers. I mean, he marketed it. We had a gas station co-op, which was more or less a failure, more or less a success, depends, you know. I mean, it was, you know. But farm workers absolutely dependent upon their automobile. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's a piece of junk, right? I mean, it just barely runs.
Yeah.
And you got to take it to a shade tree mechanic, or you got to work on it yourself. God, why not have a place? If he talked about this once, he talked about it 1,000 times. Why not have a place where farm workers could bring their cars, have access to tools and this and that? And even if they had to work on their own car, at least they'd, you know. Mm-hmm. But that was, the car was so vital to their livelihood. I mean, how could you have a movement? How could you have a union, for example, that wasn't interested in their car?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, it was just, see, a medical clinic. I mean, he was absolutely determined that he knew that if the union were ever built, he told me he didn't expect any contracts for the first 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that they came within the first 4 or 5 years was just totally mind-boggling to him. He looked upon it as a 20-year project. And he knew that at some point the union would either be built or not built. But if it were built, there would be funds for a medical plan, this kind of thing. He was just absolutely refused to turn this money over to insurance companies to let them handle it and to let them... He thought insurance companies were a total ripoff of poor people. And so he wanted to have the kind of plan where the workers, if you will, control, and there would be self-funded. They controlled the money, they controlled the benefits, mm-hmm. but there was not this, these profits paid to insurance companies for basically handling the bureaucratic nonsense. And then he believed in preventive health care. My God, he was 30 years ahead of his time. I mean, he wanted to invest money in prevention, not in urgent care, mm-hmm. not in long-term hospitalization. He thought mm-hmm. that was a total ripoff of working people, mm-hmm. that so much of the money was spent on the catastrophic illness end, mm-hmm. and not on the mm-hmm. the family end, mm-hmm. the, you know, raising your kids, yeah. having yeah. access to doctors and immunizations and you know, when you cut yourself, being able to, you know, go to the emergency room and have it paid for, mm-hmm. and this and that kind of stuff. Yeah. He was a very progressive thinker along those lines, and he did not see labor leaders doing that. I mean, and he faulted them for that. Not all of them. Yeah. I mean, in the sense, not across the board. Yeah. Some were more than others. But I mean, yeah. in terms of the labor movement, he felt that they lost it. They didn't, you know. So I don't know. Maybe that shed some.
Okay. Now, I just, you know, you said that developed more than a union. So I want to know what is this more than?
Right.
Another issue, you know, kind of running through the 63 to 73 period we're talking about here, the question of religiosity, spirituality. Take, for example, the fasts. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, a variety of opinions about them, whether it was an intrusion of a religious activity into something that is not religious.
Not in Caesar's mind.
Yeah.
Caesar saw religion as part and parcel of your daily life, uh-huh. his daily life.
Uh-huh.
And so religious symbols were important to the people, and therefore they were important to the movement. Caesar was a religious person. That doesn't mean he attended church constantly. He didn't, but he attended church a lot. When I say attended church, I mean the church came to the union. After all, I mean we had more masses within the union than could last you a couple lifetimes. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't have to. Caesar wasn't the kind of person who went to mass every Sunday. That was not what he did. Mm-hmm. I think it's just second nature to Caesar, and after all, I mean, he's dealing with people. The banner of Our Lady of Guadalupe was led the Mexican Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
He saw nothing wrong with that. He thought that was.
Yeah,
that's the way it is.
Been done 150 years before,
well,
right?
Well, right. He never saw that as an issue. Now you say there's controversy about it, whatever. Mm-hmm. There might be controversy about it now, but there didn't seem to be a lot of controversy about it at the time. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in retrospect, people will will develop.
True.
Different perspectives,
absolutely. Yeah. And I'm not naive. I mean, there were people associated with the union, even some board members of the union who were not so religiously inclined, if you will, at that level. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the gospel level kind of thing. And what opt for a more traditional labor union type of deal? Mm-hmm. Well, they sort of had to make a choice, and there was a tough choice for some, and some didn't want to make it, and some made it, and some made it part time one way and part time another way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just like, I mean, but the fact is that Caesar's charisma, of course, and engendered by the people, by the farm workers themselves, really, truly overpowered those differences to the extent that they were there. And it's like you either tolerated him if you wanted to be part of it, or you had to ignore it, or you had to leave, or, I mean, you know what I mean? It was, there were no long arguments, believe me, or debates or sessions about, well, should we or shouldn't we? Or, I mean, that's just Caesar and that and the people, and that's, there's a lot of spontaneity that happens. Yeah. I mean, when you talk about the fast and Caesar, I mean, the idea was he wanted to have a mass every day there. Well, the people came, primarily women, Filipinos and Mexicans and Anglos, and made an altar and decorated it and puts up symbols. And I mean, Caesar didn't say, do this, do that. I mean, it was like, this is what you're going to do. I mean, the fasting was a religious type of activity, and people treated it that way. It also turned out to be one of the most effective organizing tools he ever developed. But so, I mean,
that was a result of it.
Well, I don't think he intended it that way.
Yeah.
I don't think he knew what was going to happen.
Dolores Campos was just telling us last Sunday, wasn't it, that about a group of women who nightly prayed the rosary. They would gather. So it's just that sometimes the hall at 40 Acres would be full. He says,
You mean during the fast?
During the fast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he says people, they just come together and in the evening.
There was no one announced that we're going to have a rosary.
Yeah. Yeah.
People it's unbelievable. I mean, people came from Arizona. People came from hundreds and hundreds of miles away to be part of this happening. Mm-hmm. And they brought themselves, and they brought what, you know, I mean, they came to a holy act, and they brought their religious customs, they brought their religious, their prayers, they brought their whoever they were.
Yeah.
We had Indian dancers, and people coming to lay hands on Caesar. I mean, ministers. I don't mean from the middle class community. I'm talking about even from the Mexican community. I mean, people who saw the power of this person and wanted to be part of it.
And you say ministers from the Mexican? You talking about evangelicals? Or?
Yeah, sure. Uh-huh. Even in that time, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so he was able to cut across
Yes, he was, and Caesar had very high regard. He had very high regard for them, and he did not see them as a threat.
Mm-hmm.
Caesar was very ecumenical. He was very open. Also, I think Caesar saw the evangelicals as doing more for the people than the traditional parishes, or the traditional Catholic parishes, at least at that time.
Yeah.
They were more involved people. Mm-hmm. They empowered people more.
Yeah, with the emphasis on fellowship.
Yes.
Yeah.
And leadership. They developed leadership. Mm-hmm. And they had a program. Mm-hmm. And they mm-hmm. No. Caesar, no, mm-hmm. no. See, I don't know where Caesar learned this. I don't really know, but he would never permit any of us to attack or to complain against our natural allies.
Mm-hmm.
And our natural allies, first and foremost, the church, regardless of faith.
Yeah.
Labor unions, regardless.
Yeah.
As much as he had deep-seated feelings about any and all of them, or we did, or this person or that person, I mean, our natural friends, we had to take into account their problems, their annoyances with us, after all, Caesar was a crusader, and he was, he just ran cross purposes to most labor leaders, for example. They thought he was, he wouldn't negotiate, he was too too dictatorial, he was too arrogant, he was too this, he was too that. I mean, you know, because that's how they saw it, you know. Well, it doesn't mean he changed, didn't, maybe he was tempered somewhat, but he didn't change, but he didn't rail against them, he didn't piss on them, he didn't get into a fight with them.
What was interesting on the religious thing and the evangelicals is that, you know, the earlier influences of the mission band, I remember things with Padre Arturo coming through town with his big Dodge Power Wagon and the altar that would open up on the back. But one of the consistent lines was, no good Mexicans and hallelujah. In other words, you don't join the evangelicals, but it's somehow a betrayal of your Mexicanness. And yet, Cesar can draw something from the mission band and yet let that set aside.
Let that set aside. No, that's right. No, absolutely. Yeah. That's... There's only one issue that I think that Caesar had a very difficult time with setting aside. I don't think he could set it aside, and that's abortion. Mm-hmm. I think the women's movement was difficult for Caesar. Yeah. I think it was difficult for a lot of us.
Yeah, truly. I was going to say a whole lot of us have had to rethink some
things.
That's
right. Yes. But Caesar was a wonderful rethinker. He was a wonderful rethinker, mm-hmm. though. I mean, you know what I mean? He incorporated new things. He was open to new things. I mean, all of this business, you know, the gardening and the vegetarianism and the this and that. I mean, that's openness to new things. I mean, mm-hmm. had he been hidebound in the way he was raised and the way, you know, the mission band and Catholicism at that point, he would have been closed to those things. But he wasn't. He was very open to this. Abortion, I think, is one of the things that Caesar had, I think, he had troubles. I know he did. Well, I know he did. I mean, I don't think. I know. He was very... He couldn't see another side to it, another nuance to it, another...
Mm-hmm. It leads me to ask a question about something that there's been a lot of controversy swirled around, and that's the involvement with Synanon. Do you think that his propensity for listening and absorbing and arriving at new points and being able to disregard old ideas made that look or made Synanon appeal to him? That's part of what appealed to him, and that was part of an effort to...
I could cop out and say, because it's true, I was long gone before the Synanon, you know, influences or whatever. I mean, August 73, I was gone, and that wasn't even a factor, wasn't even on the horizon. That happened later on. Many other things happened later on, and I wasn't part of it. And so, you know, it would be conjecture on my part. But I will conjecture something. I mean, everyone has, you know, can do that, I guess. But it's sheer conjecture, really. I think a lot of things, but I think when I first met Caesar, I was convinced that the way to help poor people was education. And he was able to convince me that the best way to help poor people was to organize them. And I examined my experience as a high school teacher, and I understood that the people that I was teaching and having some influence on, and I could see going on to becoming doctors and thinkers and this and whatever, businessmen, whatever, were sons of people who had been organized. They were, like in San Francisco, they were primarily sons of parents whose father was a member of a labor union. Mm-hmm. They had some economic stability. They had some base, and they had, therefore, some money that they could send their kid to a private school and therefore send their kid on to college. I mean... So what does come first, the chicken or the egg? And I said, well, you know, I really believe that, and I still believe, truly, that Caesar was right, that that organization stability, family stability, whatever, comes first if you're going to have education or some of these other kinds of things. He didn't decry that at all. It's just that where are you going to start? And you only have so much to give and so much of your life, and you know what? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
All right, now. Now, I think, you know, in a strange way, and this is my conjecture, I think in a strange way, that Caesar came around at some point to thinking and to having convinced himself and believing that everything could be taught. Union administration could be taught, or administration could be taught, or that it was all in the books. Mm-hmm. It was all in the professors who wrote these books. And if you brought them, and if you talked to them, I saw this in Jerry Brown too. You talk to them, and you bring them, and they inform you, and they can teach you, and therefore I can teach others, and mm-hmm. da da da. And I know that Caesar, I was gone, you have to realize this, so, mm-hmm. But some of the times that I talked to Caesar and some of my friends afterwards, I mean, they were into heavy reading about management, and management theory, and intellectual, I mean, thinking and processing and how to, you know, that kind of thing. And
like the dialogue with Freire and these kinds of things? Paulo Freire, remember there was...
Yes, but there, who was the other? The one guy from Claremont, the professor at Claremont who wrote all these... Drucker? Wasn't he from Claremont?
Yeah, Theodore Drucker, right?
Yeah.
Theodore Drucker, right?
Yeah, I mean, didn't he write all
these... all his management.
Right.
Yeah, right.
And I know that...
One of the first of the contemporary gurus of re-engineering, reinventing, and
exactly. Okay. Now I wasn't there, so yeah. But I know that there was contact. I know that there was seminars. I know that there was readings. I know, I know because I heard it.
Yeah.
You know, what do I? But I wonder if Synanon, for example, represented that aspect of Caesar who felt that personality or people's motivations or...
Well, the slogan, the people business. Synanon, the people business.
Okay, well, that can be managed. It can be taught. It can be, I don't want to say manipulated. That's a cruel word. But it, you know what I mean? It's just to learn. I mean, it's just you just learn it and then you can... master it, and then you can. Well, I mean, I think I think that's simplistic, and I'm not saying Caesar is simplistic. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that maybe Caesar became, in a strange way, the most intellectual of us all. I mean, the most maybe he became the most. Yeah. The highest academician, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That everything is a science. It just can be, it can be taught. Yeah. First of all, it can be learned, and it can be taught.
Yeah. This idea of the organic intellectual, and he would be a prime example then of the organic intellectual rather than an academician as intellectual.
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, he maybe evolved to that point, you see, because he was a very brilliant person, but maybe evolved to the point where, you know, I mean, maybe he became his own ivory tower. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm just making it up. I don't know.